motel. "Hostage is no longer at the Vagabond," she said into the microphone. "Repeat, hostage is no longer at the Vagabond." "Kingfish is still getting a cell phone signal from room 207. Subject 2 is unaccounted for. He could still be there. Motel manager has confirmed that the only second-story room occupied on that wing is 207. Subject specifically requested an isolated room when they checked in. MDPD has evacuated the first floor. Are you greenlighting a breach?" Breach was the SWAT term for a tactical team's forced entry. Not a good idea when a hostage's whereabouts were unknown, but that was no longer the case. Andy glanced over at Littleford, who nodded. "Green light," said Andy. Pedro went to the window of room 207 and peeled back the corner of the curtain for another look at the parking lot. Nothing had changed. Same empty spaces, same parked cars. He checked the clock on the nightstand. It read 2:37 a.m. It had been almost 15 minutes since Pinky left with Jeffrey in tow. "I'll take care of him," Pinky had told him. "You wait here." Minutes later, police sirens wailed, louder by the second, as if approaching the motel. Pedro had expected to see blue flashing lights in the parking lot at any moment. Then there was silence. No swirling police beacons. Nothing. Nothing but waiting. Possibly the police had blown right past the Vagabond on their way to some other crime in progress. Maybe they'd stopped Pinky's truck. Maybe Pinky was already dead, killed in a shootout, or in custody, ratting out his partner. They could be out there, watching. Pedro turned on the TV. Breaking news updates on police activity were a criminal's best friend. Nothing useful was airing. Channel after channel of the usual wee hours programming, mostly infomercials for mattresses, sleep aids, and anything else that might spur insomniacs to open their wallets. Pedro reached for his burn phone. Pinky had told him to avoid cell usage. Burn phones still have an air card, but he needed information. It was time to make a move. Sitting in a motel room was no strategy at all. Suddenly, a blast of white light shone through the crack in the draperies, slicing across the room like a laser, brighter than the morning sun. Pedro dropped the burn phone, grabbed his pistol, and turned off the lamp on the television. The slice of light pierced the darkness, searing a white line down the middle of the room. As quickly as he could move, Pedro flipped over the double bed, shoved the mattress and box spring against the window, and barricaded the door with the dresser. The line of light was gone. The room's landline rang in the darkness. Once. Twice. Pedro yanked the wire from the phone jack. Silence. Seconds later, his burn phone rang, as if to tell him how the police had found him. Technology had given him up. The cops had literally plucked his phone number from the air. Pedro took the call and answered with two words. "Blow me." "It's over. You're surrounded. Give yourself up and save your own life." "I said, blow me." He ended the call, tossed the phone aside, and checked his pistol. 15 rounds of 9mm ammunition in the magazine. 2 spare clips in his pocket. Maybe not enough to get out alive, but enough to go down fighting. The window shattered on the other side of the barricade, and purely as a reflex, Pedro fired into his own protective barrier, squeezing off 5 quick shots into 2 feet of foam and springs. Smoke poured from inside and behind the mattress, the launched grenade having burrowed through the fabric. A cloud of chemical irritants burst forth, and Pyro Pedro was savvy enough to realize that heat from an embedded smoke grenade could quickly set a foam mattress afire. "They're trying to burn me alive." Something between panic and an acute sense of urgency washed over him and in the back of his mind were the screams of Marco Arroyo, the hiss of Pedro's own blowtorch, and the smell of burning flesh. His memories vanished as the tinny voice of authority sounded over a loudspeaker from somewhere in the parking lot.
Leave your weapon. Come out with your hands over your head.
The cloud of smoke thickened and crept across the room. Pedro's eyes began to water. He grabbed a pillowcase and covered his mouth and nose. It didn't help. He could barely breathe. Visibility was almost zero, nothing but smoke and darkness. Then he saw the flame, a burst of orange from the sheets and blanket on his mattress barricade. Smoke grenades were non-lethal, but heat was heat, and this one was turning deadly.
30 seconds, the man with the loudspeaker announced. Oh, we're coming in.
Pedro didn't wait. He pulled the dresser barricade away from the door and flung it open. The blinding spotlight only exacerbated his temporary loss of vision from the smoke grenade, but he kept running, guided by instinct alone, exploding out of the room at full speed, squeezing off shots from his semi-automatic pistol even faster than his feet were moving. The pop of return gunfire cut through the night, multiple shots from a host of strategic positions. Pedro felt a crushing blow to his chest, another to his shoulder, and an explosion in his belly. The repeated crack of his discharging weapon melded with the barrage from law enforcement. It was a single ballistic cacophony as he felt his hips slam into a railing, felt his feet whirling over his head, and felt himself floating in slow motion. For a brief but bizarre instant, he could see himself falling from the second floor catwalk. He watched the pistol drop from his hand. He could even see the assortment of gold caps that spilled from his coat pocket and caught the flash of police searchlights in midair. He saw the glint of gold all around him as his body slammed into the pavement. Chapter 64. Reuben parked in the alley behind a hardware store about a half block away from the Blue Grotto restaurant. Not another vehicle was in sight. It took only a few seconds to retrieve the folded assault rifle from his backpack, make sure the clip of Full Metal Jacket ammo was secure, and run through the usual pre-firing safety checks. All was in order. At the ready, finger on the trigger guard, he started walking. Reuben was operating on the assumption that this was all a setup, that Pinky was waiting inside the truck for him, and that Jeffrey wasn't even there. His plan was not elaborate. Spray the driver's side with bullets, change magazines, walk to other side, pump in another 32 rounds, approach carefully, make sure Pinky is dead, run. Simple and effective. Even a steel door is no match for FMJ ammo fired straight on at close range from an assault rifle. But what if Jeffrey isn't there? The thought shredded his conscience like a weed whacker. It was one thing to refuse to pay a ransom and allow Jeffrey to be killed thanks to his own stupidity. It was another thing to pull the trigger, to be his killer. He stopped at the end of the alley. A gravel parking lot stretched before him about half the size of a basketball court with only one working street lamp. The pickup truck was at the opposite end, parked against the chain-link fence. Reuben took a deep breath. It was justifiable on some levels. He'd warned Jeffrey. Stupidity has consequences. Jeffrey did this to himself. He's my brother, Reuben. Reuben started toward the truck, pushing Savannah's pleas from his mind as he raised the stock to his shoulder and took aim at the driver's door, when the voice of another woman stopped him.
FBI, freeze!
Reuben stayed calm.
You're making a mistake. My brother-in-law has been kidnapped. He's in that truck over there.
Drop your weapon and put your hands on your head.
My car is parked in the alley. Look at my backpack. There's $50,000 in ransom money.
I know there is. It's from Flight 462, Frankfurt to Miami. Now drop your gun.
Busted. Reuben couldn't see behind him, but this seemed odd. One agent? By herself?
You can't be FBI, he said. Who are you?
The engine cranked, tires spun, and the pickup was suddenly barreling toward them in reverse, bed first. Reuben and the agent hit the ground and rolled in opposite directions as the pickup passed between them. It skidded to a stop and then leapt forward, no longer in reverse. Gravel flew, and a cloud of dust rose as the truck headed straight toward the agent on the ground. Reuben sprang to his feet and jumped into the open bed. Through the rear window, he saw Pinky behind the wheel. A minute earlier, he would have put a bullet in the back of Pinky's head, but everything had changed. The truck roared past the agent, just missing her, as she rolled out of the way. Reuben stayed low but raised his rifle above the tailgate and squeezed the trigger again and again, unleashing a hailstorm of bullets that sailed across the parking lot as the truck crashed through the chain-link fence and peeled away into the night. Andy climbed to her feet and ran down the alley. Littleford was in the car, racing toward her, and met her halfway. Andy jumped in the passenger seat, and Littleford chewed her out while speeding in reverse back toward the street.
Henning! What do you think you're doing? I told you to wait for backup!
Betancourt was about to empty an Uzi into that pickup truck, she said breathless. I had to move.
Not by yourself, damn it!
The tirade continued as the car sped away from the alley.
You're lucky to be alive.
Our hostage wouldn't be alive if I hadn't done something.
Sirens blared and lights flashed behind them. A string of speeding squad cars joined their pursuit. They were suddenly part of a police armada.
So now we have backup, said Andy. Where were they 2 minutes ago?
They diverted to the Vagabond Motel.
SWAT launched a smoke grenade to flush the perp out of room 207, and it ended up in the mattress. Huge fire. Half the building is burning.
Anyone hurt?
Just Subject 1. Dead. The radio crackled. MDPD had the pickup truck in sight.
Subject entering Palmetto Expressway, southbound from Flagler Street on-ramp.
Andy keyed the microphone. There was a good reason she'd held her fire in the parking lot, and she wanted to make sure MDPD did the same.
Possible hostage inside the truck. Proceed accordingly. Roger.
Littleford hit the gas.
Andy glanced behind her. The string of squad cars was still with them. All together now.
Chapter 65. Reuben crouched low in the bed of the pickup, his windbreaker flapping as they sped onto the Palmetto. Pinky was at the wheel. The back of his head was an easy stationary target through the cab's rear window. One bullet was all it would have taken. But Reuben had lost the spare clips in his roll across the parking lot and was out of ammunition. He laid his rifle aside, pulled the pistol from his belt, clicked off the safety, and then stopped. The truck was moving like a rocket. At 3 a.m., the expressway was as wide open as a 5-lane test track. The bed vibrated beneath them, and the wheel wells roared with the power of 8 screaming cylinders. At this speed, a dead driver would mean a dead passenger. Jeffrey's face suddenly appeared on the other side of the rear window. Their eyes met. A toothless mouth fell open, and Jeffrey shouted something that was impossible for Reuben to hear. He understood nonetheless.
Bro!
The window cracked in spiderweb fashion as a bullet pierced the safety glass and punctured the tailgate just inches from Reuben's shoulder. Pinky was shooting at him. Reuben was about to return fire, but Jeffrey's face was in the way. Jeffrey was beating his fists against the cracked window, unable to shatter the safety glass, and shouting at the top of his voice.
Reuben!
The wind continued to howl. They were doing at least 80, maybe 90 miles per hour. Reuben couldn't jump without killing himself. He couldn't shoot the driver. Through the cracks beyond Jeffrey, he saw Pinky turn his head and raise his weapon. He was driving with one hand while taking aim with his pistol. Reuben was going to have to shoot first.
Reuben!
He wasn't able to get off a clean shot, but his brother-in-law wasn't just getting in the way in his usual fuck-up fashion. Like a breaching orca, Jeffrey somehow launched himself from the back of the cab. Hands duct-taped behind his back, he sailed nose-first over the front seat and belly-flopped on Pinky's shoulders. The truck veered left, then right, then back again. Reuben thrashed from side to side. The tires screeched, the brakes screamed, and the smell of burned rubber rose from the asphalt. The truck fishtailed to a stop, and Reuben smashed into the side panel. The pistol left his hand, sailing high over the side panel as if launched by a catapult. Chapter 66. The FBI was second on the scene, right behind an MDPD squad car and the black pickup. Andy and Littleford jumped out. The truck's bed was empty. A uniformed officer was tending to an unconscious man in the front seat, driver's side. From the size of him, Andy knew it was Jeffrey Beauchamp, though she wasn't sure why his arms and legs were taped like a gray mummy.
Two men fled on foot, the officer said. My partner went after one of them. The other went that way.
He was pointing toward a cluster of buildings in the darkness just beyond the guardrail.
Let's go, said Littleford.
They drew their weapons, hopped the rail, and ran down the embankment to a two-lane access road that ran parallel to the expressway. Warehouses along the access road were built to zero lot lines, each building separated from the next by a narrow alleyway. Their suspect could have fled down any one of them. A shot rang out. The agents instinctively went down. It had come from one of the alleys, but a single gunshot in the night was hard to pinpoint.
Wait for backup, said Littleford, his tone adding the words, this time.
The first responder back at the truck said his partner pursued on foot. He could be down. Two more MDPD officers arrived on foot, then another pair. They shared Andy's concern. A plan was hatched in seconds. They split into teams, one led by Andy, the other by Littleford. They sprinted to opposite corners of the warehouse, each team with its own alley to flush out before regrouping at the loading dock behind the warehouse. With her back pressed to the brick face of the building, Andy poked her head around the corner, peering cautiously down the black alley. The warehouses were much deeper than wide, nearly the length of a football field from front to back. The alley had no street lamp, or at least not a working one. The moonlight did little more than create confusing shadows in what seemed like an endless black tunnel. If there was an officer down, Andy couldn't tell. And if a shooter was in hiding, Andy couldn't tell that either. Andy hand-signaled to Littleford. He signaled back, and their coordinated sweep was underway. Andy entered the alley, keeping close to the wall, her gun at the ready. The MDPD officer worked the other wall, directly across from her. They were 10 feet into the darkness when Andy signaled to stop. They listened, and Andy reassessed. Roll-down steel shutters covered the windows and doors that faced the alley, blocking off escape routes. Corrugated boxes flattened and stacked for disposal, one on top of the other, rose in cardboard towers along the wall near the dumpster. She took another step forward, then stopped. There was a noise. Something or someone was behind the dumpster. She and her partner took cover behind a thick stack of flattened boxes and waited. Her heart pounded. The chorus of sirens in the distance grew louder. More backup was on the way. It gave her comfort. For another, it was cause for concern.
Two quick shots rang out. Andy heard the pops in the stacked cardboard. She hit the deck and saw a man running away from her. FBI! Freeze! Andy shouted. He turned and fired again in her direction, still running. Andy started to give chase but stopped quickly, her fears realized. An MDPD officer was on the other side of the dumpster, motionless. Officer down!
Andy checked his pulse, still beating. The wound was to his upper thigh. He'd had the initial presence of mind to rip a rope-like fastener from the stacked boxes and make a tourniquet, but the blood loss had pushed him near unconsciousness. Andy checked the tourniquet. The other officer radioed for help. A third gunshot pierced the darkness, the bullet whizzing overhead as Andy dropped for cover between the shooter and the fallen officer. She braced for more gunfire, but heard only the echo of footfalls on asphalt. He was making a run for it. The officer applied pressure to the first responder's leg wound.
I was a paramedic. I got this, he told Andy.
She jumped out from behind her position of cover. The shooter was well ahead, rounding the corner and exiting the alley. Andy sprinted to the corner and stopped. Bursting carelessly into the open would have made her an easy target. She peered around the corner. The loading area was shut down and deserted, save for a single 18-wheeler that backed up to the dock. The rig was parked with its external cab lights aglow. Andy could see the driver inside, behind the wheel, but he wasn't moving. Asleep? He'd probably driven all night and was sleeping in the cab until the warehouse opened, completely unaware that an armed killer was bearing down on him and his rig.
Freeze!
Her command was ignored. Andy took aim, well aware that a shot in the back was a dicey situation.
I said freeze!
He continued toward the rig. A string of dangerous possibilities flashed through Andy's mind. The driver might be taken hostage. He might be pistol-whipped, yanked from the rig, and viciously thrown to the ground. Or he might be shot in the head at point-blank range, a senseless murder, the way those New York thugs had shot Littleford's father in the armored truck. Andy fired a warning shot into the sky. It woke the driver, but didn't stop the gunman, who jumped up onto the running board and flung open the door. There was another shot from inside the cab. The gunman's head snapped back. His gun flew as he tumbled backward and landed on the pavement. Andy shouted to the driver, FBI! And he raised his hands. He wasn't armed. Andy ran toward the rig, and as she approached, she could see that the passenger door was also wide open. Littleford was standing on the running board, gun in hand. In the sweep, he'd come around on the other side of the warehouse through the alley. Andy checked the body and recognized the face. Pinky Paris was dead. She climbed onto the running board and displayed her FBI shield to the terrified truck driver. His eyes were like silver dollars.
Are you all right, sir?
I guess so. What the hell is this about?
Andy looked across the cab straight at Littleford. He was still on the running board, but his mind seemed to be elsewhere. Somewhere in the past.
It's about a lot of things, he said, as he stepped down from the truck. Chapter 67.
Reuben woke at 6:45 a.m., to the sound of an annoying buzzer on the nightstand. He sat up in the darkness, confused, momentarily forgetting that he was in a motel. The buzzer continued. He hadn't set the alarm clock, but apparently the room's previous guest had been an early riser. He silenced the damn thing with a slap of the button and settled back into the pillow. Running from the cops was exhausting work. With such a huge head start, he'd easily won the foot race with the MDPD officers who had given chase from the Palmetto Expressway. He needed rest, but the night had cost him much more than sleep. His car? Gone. The assault rifle and backup pistol? Gone. The backpack was gone too, along with the ransom money for Jeffrey. Another 50,000 squandered. Reuben was down to $300 in change in his wallet. But it was more than enough to pay cash for the room. Plenty of guests paid cash at the Princess Lodge, a pink stucco motel with kitschy themed suites such as the Jungle Room and the Disco Room. Each unit had its own garage, a convenient cover for the businessmen who might be worried that a divorce lawyer was hiding in the bushes, ready to snap a photograph of the new girl in HR, stepping out of her boss's Porsche 911. Reuben found the garage particularly useful, having arrived in a stolen car. He'd lost one backup firearm, but he still had his ankle pistol, which had done the trick at the all-night gas station. The poor kid pumping gas into his car had wisely handed over the keys when staring down the barrel of a gun. Gotta get some rest. It was futile. He couldn't sleep, but it hurt to roll out of bed. The wild ride in the bed of the pickup had left him bruised and battered. He was actually worried about Jeffrey. His stunt had been amazingly courageous. Stupid, but courageous. Pinky must have been shocked. It was hard enough to drive and shoot at the same time, but virtually impossible with 300 pounds of blubber pressing down on your neck and shoulders. Reuben walked to the bathroom, splashed cold water on his face, and returned to the room. He wanted to call Savannah, but he couldn't possibly reach out to her. Surely the police were all over his wife and mother-in-law. If his cell hadn't been tapped earlier, it sure was at this stage of the game, and likewise for Savannah's. Going to his mother-in-law's house or anywhere near Savannah was out of the question. The digital alarm clock sounded again. He'd hit snooze on the first try. He silenced it for good and noticed the time. 5 a.m. Everything that happened after 11 p.m. would be on the morning news sunrise edition. He turned on the TV, sat on the edge of the bed, and scrolled through the local channels until he found a news anchor woman who couldn't have looked happier to have been awake since 3 a.m. The lead story bore the tagline, "Cash Landing." The driver has been identified as Craig Pinky Perez, who was pronounced dead after a shootout with police that left one MDPD officer wounded. Sergeant Frank Sanchez was taken to Jackson Memorial Hospital and is reportedly in satisfactory condition. Perez's nephew, Jeffrey Beauchamp, reportedly found covered in gray duct tape, was also taken to Jackson and is in good condition. Reuben smiled to himself, glad his brother-in-law had made it. The warmth quickly faded. Law enforcement is still searching for Carl Reuben Betancourt, the suspected mastermind behind the multi-million-dollar heist at Miami International Airport just 3 weeks ago. Police are also searching for a second man who has disappeared with Betancourt's 29-year-old wife, Savannah. Reuben felt chills as a photograph of Savannah appeared on the screen. According to police, Savannah Betancourt was staying with her mother when a man forcibly entered the house and took Savannah with him. That man is described as a black male, possibly Jamaican. He left in a white Japanese model sedan. Anyone having information relating to Reuben Betancourt's whereabouts or to Savannah Betancourt's disappearance is asked to call Crime Stoppers at the number on your screen. In other news, Reuben tuned out. That was all he needed to hear. Ramsey, you son of a bitch. He reached for the landline but thought better of it. Caller ID on Ramsey's end would reveal Reuben's location. His cell was useless, but it occurred to him that he still had the burn phone that Jasmine had given him. He started dialing Ramsey's cell, but again he stopped. Did he dare dial Ramsey's number? The news report had said they were looking for a black man, possibly Jamaican. Had they figured out yet that it was Ramsey? Reuben debated it. The bastard had Savannah. This was no time to be timid. But he also had to be smart. Think, Reuben. Think. Then it came to him. The news report had made no mention of Jasmine, but Reuben had seen her true colors. He dialed her cell. It came as no surprise when it was Ramsey who answered.
Been waiting on this call for 2 hours, man. Where you been?
What did you do to Savannah?
Nothing. Got it right here. This one is going to cost you everything, man. Keep the burn phone on. I'll call you later.
Ramsey hung up before Reuben could reply. He gripped the phone so tightly that he nearly cracked the LCD.
You do that, Ramsey, he said aloud. You call me.
He put the phone away and reached for the gun on the nightstand.
I can't wait to blow you away, Mon.
Chapter 68. Room service brought him pancakes, bacon, and coffee. Housekeeping brought up 6 disposable razors and a pair of scissors. Reuben ate breakfast in his room and then shaved his head. He barely recognized himself in the mirror, which was exactly the point. It was safe to go outside, but he didn't take any unnecessary chances. He walked down the street to Target, bought clean clothes, a hat, sunglasses, and enough food and toiletries for 3 days. Then it was back to the motel. He kept the burn phone on. No call came. By late afternoon, he couldn't sit idle any longer. He started pacing. He checked to see if the phone had died. Over 30% battery left. He made doubly sure the ringer was on. Yep, Westminster chimes. For no reason at all, he checked his gun, a small Smith & Wesson revolver. Still loaded. He noticed that the naked babies patterned into the wallpaper were actually cupids shooting their arrows of love, more proof that any man who would bring a woman to this joint didn't appreciate the value of hard-earned cash. Cash. He had no way to pay Savannah's ransom. Shit! Ramsey hadn't mentioned a number, but clearly he was thinking big.
This one is going to cost you everything, man.
Refusing to ransom Savannah wasn't an option. This wasn't Jeffrey the Cokehead. He had around 2 million left by his count, but all of it was stashed at the house. He couldn't go home. He needed fast cash, lots of it, and he needed to get it from somewhere the police wouldn't be looking for him. He knew just the place. He put on his hat, which was actually one of those tight-fitting do-rags that football players wore under their helmets. Camouflage fabric. He liked the new look, especially with the sunglasses and the black shirt. The jeans were wide-leg, carpenter-fit style to accommodate the ankle holster. The new Reuben was ready to go. He called for a taxi and 10 minutes later met it outside the lobby.
South Miami, he told the driver.
The old Haitian gentleman cued the meter. The sun was setting as they pulled away from the motel, and the driver seemed to be having difficulty with the oncoming headlights. His ears weren't so good either. The radio was blasting, tuned to a crackly AM station and live coverage of the Miami Dolphins football game. Reuben's mind drifted back to another Sunday afternoon when he was with Jeffrey and Pinky and Marco's pickup truck, the 3 men listening to the Dolphins game on the radio while waiting for the call from Octavio at the warehouse. A mere 3 weeks, and so much had changed.
Reuben was the only one who wasn't dead or under arrest. And the Dolphins were out of contention for the playoffs. Fucking Finns.
Stop here. They were a half block from Whip and Dip, the ice cream shop where Jeffrey had bought a banana split for breakfast. From there, Reuben could walk. He paid the driver, crossed the tree-lined street to the hardware store, and purchased two lengths of nylon rope and a roll of duct tape. He used the store's rear exit, which faced the residential part of town, and followed the curved walkway into the quiet High Pines neighborhood.
Savannah kidnapped. It was his fault again, just as it was his fault that she'd fallen off the back of his motorcycle.
It was hard to find any silver lining in the motorcycle accident, but maybe the kidnapping was a godsend. This was his chance to step up and prove to Savannah how much he loved her, how he would do anything to get her back, how she meant more to him than money.
Sully's money, at least.
Reuben didn't know the address, and the ranch-style houses could look a lot alike after dark, but Reuben remembered the huge Royal Poinciana tree in the front yard. He walked around to the back. A thick 10-foot ficus hedge ran along the property line. Sully liked his privacy. Good thing. Reuben took the pistol from his ankle holster and went to the sliding glass doors and back. The house was the typical 21st century renovation of 1960s construction, with all but the interior load-bearing walls removed to create that open Florida floor plan. Reuben listened. The television was playing loudly enough to be heard through the glass door. Sully was a Dolphins fan, or maybe not. Reuben could see him sleeping on the couch. He tried the door. It slid right open, unlocked. Reuben crossed the kitchen to the family room. Sully didn't move from the couch. He was on his back, snoring loudly. Much more than a 5 o'clock shadow covered his face, as if he hadn't shaved all weekend. He'd probably been out all night at the Gold Rush, selling Rolex watches. Reuben was betting on it. He went to the couch and pressed the muzzle of his handgun to Sully's forehead. Sully stirred, and then his eyes blinked open.
"Don't move," said Reuben, "or I will blow your brains out."
Reuben was back in his hotel room by 8. Sully, he presumed, was still locked in the closet, bound with nylon rope and his mouth taped shut. Reuben's take had been worth the trip, almost $100,000. He took 6 Rolex watches, too. Reuben knew they weren't worth Sully's asking price of $25,000 apiece, but maybe Ramsey would be as gullible as Jeffrey. The phone rang. Westminster Chimes. The burn phone. Reuben grabbed it. The incoming number was Jasmine's, the same number Ramsey had called from that morning.
"I'm listening," said Reuben.
"Reuben!"
He nearly dropped the phone. It was Savannah. She was whispering, her voice filled with urgency.
"Thank God you answered. I've been kidnapped."
"Are you okay?"
"Yes. No, I mean..."
"Calm down, okay? Is Ramsey in the room with you right now?"
"No. He just walked out. I saw him use this phone to call you this morning. He doesn't know I have it. He left it in his bathrobe, so I grabbed it and hit redial."
"His bathrobe? Where are you?"
"It's a club. Ramsey brought me in the back door last night and locked me up in some kind of private sex room. This place is so gross. And Ramsey is creeping me out even more with all his talk about married people having sex with other married people."
"You're at night moves," said Reuben, his words simultaneous with the realization.
"Yes, that's it. You know it?"
"Your uncle practically lived there. Savannah, listen to me. You have to try to get out while Ramsey is away. Look around the room. Is there any escape?"
"No, I checked. There's no window. The door is locked from the outside.
The first time Ramsay left me alone, I banged on the wall for help. He came back and slapped me so hard I thought my jaw was broken.
I'm going to shoot that son of a bitch.
Reuben, no! That's not the answer. If you know this place, just come. All we have is each other. Jeffrey's under arrest. If I call the police on this phone, we'll go to jail too. The cops will never believe that we had nothing to do with the heist. Who knows what Jeffrey is telling them? We have to run as far as we can for as long as we can. Just bring whatever's left of Jeffrey's money, and you and I will run away to another country if we have to and never look back. Start over.
He swallowed hard. She was still referring to the money as Jeffrey's. There was hope. Are you serious about all this?
Yes. People like Ramsay will keep kidnapping us as long as they think we have the damn money, so we might as well have it.
Reuben's heart swelled. I promise you, Savannah, everything is going to be okay. I love you so much.
Ramsay is unlocking the door. I have to go. Hurry.
I will, he said, as the call ended. I'm on my way. Chapter 69. Reuben didn't wait for a taxi. For two bills, a valet attendant at the motel was willing to borrow a Porsche from one of the overnight guests and drive him to Night Moves. They got there in 15 minutes. The Porsche squealed out of the dark parking lot and headed back to the motel as Reuben hurried inside. Sunday was not the busiest night of the week, but the club was never empty in late November, the official start of South Florida's season. The dance room was straight ahead beyond a set of double doors, but Reuben didn't get past reception. The attendant stopped him, a leggy blonde whose lips looked bee-stung.
Can I help you, sir?
He hesitated. The slightest hint at a kidnapping or criminal activity of any sort would prompt her to call 911, which would land Reuben in jail. I'm here to meet up with my wife.
So is everyone else, she said, and then she smiled. A little Night Moves humor.
Reuben didn't find it funny. I'm in a bit of a hurry. If you could let me inside to look around, I would really appreciate it.
If you're not a member, you have to buy a day pass.
Reuben handed her 100. Does this cover it?
Amply. Now, if you could just fill out some information for me.
No paperwork, he said as he handed her another 100. She took it, and he started past her.
One more thing, she said, stopping him. We have a strict no drugs, no weapons policy here.
The pistol was strapped to his ankle beneath his pant leg. No problem.
Good. Have fun.
Reuben continued to the double doors and entered the dance room. The loud music and flashing lights in a rainbow of colors were like any other club. The pornographic videos playing on flat-screen televisions around the room were distinctly Night Moves. About a dozen couples were on the dance floor, but it was more like group dancing, which made it hard to tell who was coupled with whom. No one was completely naked, it was still early, but several women would have caught Reuben's attention if he hadn't been on a mission. He took a good look around the entire room, keeping an eye out for Ramsay. The bar was to the right. To the left were couches and built-in lounge seating. Low-slung tables were outfitted with brass poles for wannabe strippers. Reuben saw no sign of Ramsay, but he spotted the table where he and Octavio had met with Pinky to plan the heist. It had been several months, but he remembered Pinky saying something about private rooms in the back, the baths, he'd called them. The entrance was behind the DJ. Savannah had to be back there. Reuben started across the dance floor. The music transitioned from a song Reuben didn't recognize to a remix of Rihanna's latest hit, which drew out even more dancers. Reuben zigzagged his way through a sea of wandering eyes. The dance floor was the epicenter in a land of opportunity, the place where hookups began. A woman started to dance toward him, a hot brunette wearing a sequined top that rode up above her navel when she raised her arms to the music. He avoided making eye contact, but she wasn't about to let him pass, playfully getting in his way.
Want to dance?
No, thanks.
She smiled and moved in toward him, close enough to be heard over the music, close enough to let him smell her perfume.
Aw, come on, handsome.
No, I mean it.
She signaled to her girlfriend, who joined them. Blondes weren't typically his type, but this one was an incredible dancer, great body. Reuben was suddenly at the top of a blonde and brunette triangle, the stuff of male fantasy. But he wasn't biting. He tried to move past them, but the blonde with the hot body stepped in his way, still dancing.
You're cute, she said.
I have to go.
Shy, too. I like that.
Would you blush if I took my top off? Reuben was starting to sweat. It must have been the lights.
Let's get some champagne, said the brunette.
And some baby oil,
her friend said. More sweating. It wasn't the lights. He was starting to feel like the guy who finally gets propositioned by Eva Longoria and Charlize Theron on his honeymoon. They moved closer, one for each arm.
Really, ladies, I don't...
The next few moments were a blur. Before Reuben could even begin to appreciate what was happening, the brunette had his right arm, the blonde had his left, his hands went behind his back, and a pair of handcuffs closed over his wrists. It was one seamless motion, and it ended with Reuben down on the dance floor, flat on his belly. The brunette pushed his face toward the lacquered hardwood, and the muzzle of a gun was suddenly at the base of his skull.
FBI,
you're under arrest. The music stopped. A barrage of white light switched on. As the crowd dispersed, there were a few screams, but things settled down quickly. The dancers on the floor were mostly law enforcement officers, FBI agents, and MDPD officers from the Joint Tomcat Unit, headed by Agent Littleford, performing their very first undercover roles. Andy flashed her FBI shield before Betancourt's eyes. The blonde removed her wig and read him his Miranda rights.
You have the right. This is a terrible mistake! My wife is in danger! She's been kidnapped! She's being held in one of those back rooms!
Your wife was never kidnapped, said Andy.
Yes! The kidnapper is a Jamaican guy named Ramsey. He called me this morning.
A Jamaican FBI agent called you.
What?
Ramsey was arrested at the Sunset Motel last night, along with his sidekick, Jasmine.
But I heard it on the news. Savannah was kidnapped. She called me from here.
She called you from the FBI field office.
Huh?
Your wife got herself a lawyer, told us everything, and agreed to do whatever was necessary to bring you into custody and to recover as much of the money as possible, Mr. Betancourt.
No. Savannah would never do that.
She would, and she did. Deal with it, hotshot. And welcome to the FBI. Chapter 70. At 9 o'clock Monday morning, Andy had a meeting at the U.S. Attorney's Office in downtown Miami. Littleford was with her at the table in a windowless conference room. They were silent observers, along with two other prosecutors from the criminal division. The chief prosecutor for the major crime section sat in the middle, the FBI agents to his left, and the prosecutorial team to his right. The chief did the talking for the government. Savannah Betancourt wasn't there, but her lawyer was on the other side of the table. He did more talking than anyone. The deal was no jail time, he said. The FBI appreciated Savannah's cooperation. After Reuben had told her that he was essentially trying to buy his child, Savannah was emotionally done with him.
After meeting Mindy Barrett and learning that Reuben had bedded a teenager, she was utterly disgusted. Savannah left him, went to her mother's, and contacted the FBI. Things got more complicated when she hired a lawyer. It was Savannah's attorney who had conceived the plan to stage her kidnapping. At first, the FBI had balked at the idea. They didn't need Savannah's help to capture Reuben. But they didn't know if he had more money stashed outside the house. If so, the best shot at recovering it was to lead Reuben to believe that Savannah was ready to run off to Antigua with him and whatever money he could get his hands on. Her lawyer struck Andy as a pretty smart guy. His name was Jack Switek. "A deal is a deal," said Switek. The chief measured his response. "No jail time on the front end of the heist is fine, but I have a problem giving her a pass on accessory after the fact. It's clear that she took an active role in hiding the money."
"Savannah didn't hide any of the money."
"She admits she did. My client admits no such thing. She wore a Rolex watch to her birthday party that was purchased with stolen money. It's the judgment of our prosecutorial team that she has not been forthcoming about what happened to that watch. For all we know, she has it stashed away somewhere." Andy showed no reaction, but the statement took her by surprise. That wasn't her judgment. "She made her husband take the watch back to the dirtbag who sold it to him," said Switek. The chief checked his paperwork.
"That's not what Ms. Betancourt told us."
"Told you when?"
"The first interview with the FBI," he said, glancing toward Andy. "That was before she hired me as her lawyer."
"I realize that. Nonetheless, here's the 302,
he said, handing a copy to the lawyer. "It's all right there in black and white." Andy watched from across the room as Switek read. As per standard FBI procedure, Andy had conducted the initial interview while another agent took notes. A 302 was an FBI agent's written record of what a witness said, created by the agent from the agent's notes. It was not a verbatim transcript or statement signed by the witness. Switek looked up from the document when he finished.
"Nowhere in this 302 does it say my client kept the Rolex."
"It doesn't say she made her husband take it back either," the chief said.
"Maybe she was never asked that question."
"It's the kind of thing she would have mentioned even if not asked."
"Maybe she did say it, but the interrogating agent simply failed to write it down."
"I don't think so," the chief said.
Switek looked over at Andy, one half of the FBI's presence in the room. She said nothing, but she wasn't entirely comfortable with the way the prosecutor was presenting the 302. Switek accepted her silence and addressed the group as a whole. "If the FBI would join the 21st century and record interviews, we wouldn't be having this disagreement." Littleford spoke up.
"It's not the Bureau's policy to electronically record witness interviews.
And the FBI is also the only law enforcement agency in the modern world that adheres to that policy."
"We do things differently."
"Yes, you do," said Jack. "And we all know that the reason the Bureau doesn't record interviews is Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 1001, which makes it a felony for anyone to make a false statement to the FBI. If there's no verbatim record of what the witness actually said, whatever words the agent deigns to write in the 302 become, in effect, the witness's words. Whatever words the agent deigns to omit from the 302 becomes the witness's omissions. The witness can never contradict anything that the agent writes or chooses not to write in the 302 without facing the threat of felony charges under Section 1001.
Pretty nifty system you've got going there.
Very J. Edgar.
"That is a complete distortion," the chief said.
"Is it?"
"Well, excuse me one second."
Switek grabbed his iPhone and dictated a message, staring straight at the section chief as he spoke.
"Reminder to self. Write op-ed for the Miami Herald regarding abuse of 302s by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida."
He put the phone away.
"Sorry about that. Anyway, where was I?" The chief assistant glanced toward the prosecutorial team to his right, then toward the FBI agents to his left, but his eye contact with Littleford lasted longest. Without words, recorded or otherwise, the two agencies seemed to come to an understanding that Savannah Betancourt wasn't worth the fight.
I think we were all about to agree on no jail time, said the prosecutor.
The meeting ended around 10. Andy and her boss headed across the street to the Cuban coffee shop on the corner. The sun was shining warmly, the streets were utterly flat, and it felt nothing like the chilly walks that Andy and her old boss used to take down the steep hill from the Seattle field office to the Starbucks on Spring Street. But Miami was her new home, and Andy was getting used to it. They ordered two espressos at the counter and then found a table by the open window. The FBI had recovered the money at the Betancourt's house and at Pinky's warehouse, as well as the $100,000 that Reuben had taken from Sully. They'd actually believed Jeffrey Beauchamp when he swore in his mother's soul that he couldn't remember how much he'd given to his godfather for safekeeping, which was all he had left. In all, close to $3 million was unaccounted for. Andy stirred a little spoonful of raw sugar into her demitasse. Do you think we'll find any more of the money?
Nope, said Littleford.
You think Savannah knows where any of it is? He thought about it.
I really don't believe she does.
Andy tasted her coffee. How is she paying Switek?
Good question.
He must be expensive.
They're all expensive.
But he strikes me as better than most. That can't come cheap.
I suppose.
Is he strictly criminal defense?
You're awfully inquisitive about this guy.
No, I'm not. I'm picking up a certain vibe that you're hoping he might specialize in something other than criminal defense.
I'm just talking.
This case will be closed soon enough. If you'd like to meet him, I'm sure. Andy coughed in her espresso.
No, no, not at all.
I'm just saying he's a good lawyer.
Littleford smiled. The lady doth protest too much.
Now you're being ridiculous.
His father was the governor of Florida. That was long before you moved here. The old man was a good guy, always supportive of law enforcement. Jack, on the other hand, made a name for himself defending death row inmates.
Great. One from the dark side.
Andy glanced across the coffee shop and did a double take.
Switek took a seat at the counter. He didn't seem to notice Andy or her boss by the window, even though they were close enough to hear him order a café con leche in Spanish.
Really bad Spanish. Littleford caught Andy looking. You know, I'm good here sitting by myself, said Littleford. There's an empty seat at the counter. Why don't you go over there and say hello to him?
You can't be serious.
Hey, you can't be any worse than my wife's cousin.
Andy smiled, then shook her head. It's pointless. FBI agent, criminal defense lawyer? How could that turn out to be anything but disaster?
You're probably right. Never work.
Exactly, said Andy, glancing over once more. That would never work.
This is Jonathan Davis. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Cash Landing by James Grappando. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2015 by James Grappando. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.